more questions after the panel presentations as well. But for now, could we just thank John again for his keynote presentation? And at this stage, I'm going to invite John to stay exactly where he is, really, but to invite my colleague, Dr. Conor Galvin, to come forward. He's going to chair our panel, and to invite all our invited panelists as well to come forward and to sit up here at the front. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. That's grand. Come one, come all, as they say.
Yes.
That's right. Because you're up for that.
No, not at all.
We all be walking
Good afternoon, colleagues. We're on the, we're on the final straight at this stage, and I've been given strict instructions to make sure that certain people don't miss certain taxis because airplanes don't hang around, and so on and so forth.
Yesterday.
Well, that's okay. We'll do our best to make sure we get out here to time. So the closing panel of the SCOTUS conference has always been an opportunity to do two things. It's an opportunity for the panelists to give us a sort of a roundout, a closing comment, an observation that comes from their personal experiences or that ideally comes from within the conference itself. And it's an opportunity then for delegates to the conference to actually address the panelists directly or to raise any burning issues that they feel need to be brought to the attention of the panel or to the group generally. Normally, they take the form of questions, but we're open to, you know, we're open to invention around the concept of questions. So let's start with that. Traditionally, also, we ask the newer members of the staff, the newer members of the panel, rather, in the sense people who've not spoken to the conference already, to give a little bit of information about themselves, sort of a little two-minute talk. And ordinarily, I then push them away from the mic after 2 minutes and we continue with the questions. So in that tradition, I'm going to start firstly by asking each member of the panel to introduce themselves very briefly and to make a kind of a credo statement, a belief statement about what it is that drives you professionally. So what is it that actually drives you professionally that brings you to conferences like this on days like this when we could all be doing different things? Can we start at the end, Andy, with you, please? Because, you know, you're furthest from
okay. Folks, my name's Andy Brown, and I'm Head of Arts and Humanities and the Head of the B.Ed. Primary Degree at Stramlos University College. And I was asked to do this morning because I think somebody else has dropped out. And it's a huge pleasure and a privilege to be sitting here, especially with some of the people on this panel. But I am playing catch up. But my credo, I was talking to some of the others, is obviously to do something every day that challenges you. And this is it for me now, this morning. But what drives me is my passion to see this being done right, is my passion for children, my passion for education, my passion for sending out into our schools and colleges, people who put children first, who love children. And the other passion I have is that we are a profession. And I'm going to speak a little bit more about that a bit later on, but anybody that uses the term teacher training gets very short shift from me, and more of that later.
Good, thank you. Thank you indeed. Liam.
My name is Liam Wegamont. My day job is I'm the principal of a Protestant comprehensive school on the north side of Dublin called Mount Temple. And I do a small bit of other work for an organization called GEAN, Global Education Network Europe, which is a combination of ministries of education and ministries of foreign affairs focused on global learning. Why do I do this sort of thing? Because I believe in the relationship between education and social change. And I also happen to believe that in the dialogue between policy, practice, and research, there is the possibility of doing what we do better.
Thank you, Lynn. Excellent. Maeve, we're vaguely familiar with you, but
you
know,
are a bit
go
familiar
for it,
with
yes.
me. Maeve O'Brien, Dublin City University, and I'm the head of the School of Human Development there. So that's kind of a clue. I've spent my whole life in education, both as a student, a teacher, a researcher,
yeah,
a practitioner,
why?
And
why,
academic.
Why?
Because I am absolutely passionate that education, just as I talked about yesterday, holds those two prongs of a value for us in society. So it helps us to make a better society in terms of equality and social justice, but it's also for our unique human development. And that's Freire's statement about education is for liberation and humanisation.
Thank you.
That's it.
Ashley.
I'm Ashley Galway. I'm principal of a small inner city school in Belfast, which sits right on an interface. I suppose it's really hard to kind of summarise what we do in a minute and a half, but the reason why I would be here is that I'm passionate about collaboration, about making a difference for young people, and I don't think we should isolate ourselves in education. I think schools are the perfect vehicle for social change, and I just think we need to convince other government departments of that and other government agencies to work with us, because we are doing a lot more than what traditionally teaching was about. The reason why I go to work every day, and even on my worst days, is because we are usually the best part of our children's day, and it's really important to remember that, and we have such a responsibility.
Spoken like a true teacher. Okay, thank you. John.
Why am I still doing this when I'm retired?
Yes, yes.
Why am I still doing this? I think it's because I'm passionate about production of the development of really good quality teachers. Something that I learnt sitting around the tea table when I was a teenager with my dad as he came home from primary school every day. That's kind of where it comes from. I've gone into higher education. I am passionate about what it can contribute. And I'm also deeply aware of what it can't. The things that it simply cannot do, and the importance of it working collaboratively with others in the field to actually produce those good quality teachers. So, and that's why I'm still doing it. I need to stop, but there we are. I don't seem to. If we get good opportunities like coming to talk here, then I can't kind of resist, because it actually still matters to me.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. So, traditionally, then, panelists are asked to give a very brief comment or observation to. Or 3 minutes is usually the guidance on that. But we're not going to hold you to task. If you want to, you know, shorten it to a minute and a half, you know, there's no penalty points involved or whatever. But basically the challenge is to, in either one of two things, to either respond to the conference, what you've seen, what your takeaway moments are, or alternatively to start from more or less from the ground and say, you know, what insight do you want to offer us in that brief 2 to 3 minutes about the importance of working for the common good and so on. So again, the keynotes will be sort of excused slightly from this, but we'll come back to you on another question. But the three new panelists, please. Who would like to begin? Would you like to toss for it, or will I volunteer you?
You volunteer.
Okay, Liam, you're volunteered. All right, off you go.
Okay, well, I usually start by asking people to stand up and reach for the ceiling. Do you fancy standing up and reaching for the ceiling?
Yeah, go on.
Well, stand up and reach for the ceiling. Go on. I dare you. And if a man of my girth can, everyone else in the room, I hope, can. Thank you. Thanks a lot. That made me feel better. I'll be as brief as I possibly can. I thank you for the invitation. I believe our understanding of the common good is related to other notions that are crucial to education and by extension to teacher education. Notions such as solidarity, social justice, democracy, protest, critical thinking, etc. I could go on. But to structure things a little, I think that our understanding of the common good is related to the who, the what, the why, the where, and even the when of teacher education. And maybe a question on each of those. In regard to the who, we have a more diverse, more complex, and thankfully more rapidly changing society than heretofore. But what does our understanding of the common good ask us in terms of who's missing from our teaching staff rooms, from our communities of those who learn to teach and those who teach how to teach, in terms of class, in terms of ethnic diversity, in terms of gender diversity? Where are the migrant teachers in our staff rooms? These are some of the questions that come to me from the focus on the who that the common good hints at. What we teach, who learns what, and what teacher educators need to know and to learn is also related to our common good. What traditions of knowledge and learning must we recuperate for the 21st and the 22nd century? What needs to be reinterpreted and redeemed, but what also needs to be ignored as counterproductive to the common good? We could ask similar things of the why, but essentially, why educate if not for the common good? Where? Here the notion of common good, I think, gives us some hints for both the locus and the focus of education. And we must take account of the fact that in our world, our students and our own relationship with space, with geography, with location has changed. Our children at break time can talk as easily to their friend in France as to their friend in the corridor beside them. But with this ease of relocation comes a dislocation from the local. And I think this is both an opportunity and a challenge for education and for teacher education. If the locus becomes both local and global, must not the focus also become local and global? I could also say something of time and how a lens of the common good might say something about when we educate. Schools are all about time, but I begin to think I might be running out of time.
No, I'll give you another 30 seconds if it's worth
it. I would suggest that looking via the lens of the common good at the question of time in regard to education might tell us some interesting things about the past, the present, and the future. And I was tempted to either quote Ricoeur or Billy Bragg in finalization. Yeah. Shall I go with Billy Bragg? Yeah. Because, unfortunately, those who are not that interested in the common good are very good at stories, and we're not so good at stories. Billy Bragg talks about the diggers who in 1649 came to St. George's Hill to express the people's will. And it's been a long time since I've been kicked out of a conference, but we come to work the lands in common and to make the waste ground grow. This earth divided, we shall make whole, so it will be a common treasury for all. And while Leotard is right, we don't need a grand narrative. We do need little stories like that of the common good if education is to change the world towards greater justice.
Lynn. Thanks. Thank you very much indeed, Lynn.
Coming from a completely different viewpoint, I think, and a different perspective. I have been in my current school now for 26 years in January. We're a small school, as I said, on an interface, so we have realised that we have a lot to do in our school to meet the needs of our children. It isn't located in a very socially deprived area, and with that comes lots and lots of issues. We try to address those through various supports, and we have a nurture room, a speech and language unit, and a key stage 2 unit. So what we've realised and what I've realised over the last 26 years is we need to change all the time. We need to be meeting the needs of our children in more creative ways, and we also need to build the capacity of our staff. These issues and problems actually don't disappear, and a lot of other government agencies and a lot of other organisations can kind of put it back to school or signpost children on, but the children are in our classrooms and we need to be equipped to support them every day. I do believe that schools are the perfect vehicle for social change. I do believe that we need to address the issues that families have as a whole if we're going to make a difference for the children in our care. We do work very closely, because as I said, we're an interface. We work very closely with our partner school, Holy Family, which is just a stone's throw from our own school, and we have tested that theory over the years many, many times. So we decided, rather than throw stones at each other, we would have develop a partnership about 15 years ago, and we've done that very, very quietly. The reason why we didn't court any publicity was because if we do it quietly, no one can object and no one can stop us. So we've gone from police presence every afternoon and morning when we collect and leave the children off for school events, being on the news at night, evacuating the school 2 and 3 times a week, to our parents, children and staff now working together in a real partnership and a real friendship. The first person I texted this morning was the principal of Holy Family, and she was very sympathetic that I was coming here today.
It's all right, we'll get her next year.
Yes, yeah, oh yes. But it's been really important, and that actually is what I'm saying about, you know, the changes that we can make on the ground. The school that we're, you know, is right on the interface, so our children would never have turned right whenever they went out of school. They couldn't have, which seems very strange for some people, but equally Holy Family parents had never seen the bottom of the limestone road. When I first went to the school, I didn't know that you didn't go right, but I knew there was a great bakery at the top of the road. And when I came back to my own staff, they all asked me, where did you get that sandwich? And they were shocked and horrified that I had gone, I mean, yards away to a shop. Slowly but surely we chipped away at that. It took me a while, but I then did the sandwich run every day. So it's those kind of breaking down those barriers. 8 years ago when I took over as principal, we were still busing the children between the two schools, and as I say, it's less than a 3-minute walk. The first day that we were doing a joint session, the children asked me how we were going to get there, and I says, we're walking. And that was the first day that we walked between the two schools, and it was the first time somebody had walked up the limestone road. And it was very powerful, and it was very important that we did that. And we now have parents working together, and last Friday we had a cuppa and a crusty morning with our parents, and we had 25 parents from Holy Family and Curry working together to plan what they wanted to do in the year ahead. And we're furious that it had taken us 6 weeks into the term to get them all together. Facebook's a wonderful thing, and they're all on Facebook together as well. So it's those breaking down barriers, and we as a school and practitioners have great power to do that. So that would be my insight to the common good.
Thanks very much indeed. And I'm going to take that metaphor of the sandwich walk and the sandwich run with me as well. That's absolutely super. Andy.
Chair, you said we could do this whatever way you want.
Absolutely, but so, please don't kind of, you know, have us running around.
No, no.
Okay, right, go on.
As a dramatist, I thought I might present through the medium of mime, if no one minded. But then I realised you wouldn't hear me, so I thought I'd just keep going anyway. I once was at a conference, and before his halcyon days of having to go on to Bake Off and Strictly, Ed Balls was the Education Secretary for England and Wales, and I listened to Ed Balls speak at the conference. And something he said really struck me when he talked about key workers like nurses, police officers and teachers. And because I was chairing that conference, I felt I could issue a quiet challenge to him afterwards and said, and I mean no disrespect at all to nurses and police officers, I said, Ed, how was it that a generation ago we would have spoken about professionals like doctors, solicitors and teachers, and now we speak about key workers like police officers, nurses and teachers? Well, Maeve and I could talk about neoliberal globalization and being etc., 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 but there's no doubt that our profession, and it is a profession, has been and is under attack from politics, from the media. During the 80s and 90s, we became not the panacea and the cure for all ills, but the problem. We weren't doing enough, we were lazy, etc., etc., etc. But we are a profession, and we have a professional status. And professionals should be agents of social change, and professionals have a responsibility to be agents of social change, and professionals have a responsibility to change socially and positively for the common good. And I think that's what I'm taking out of this conference as well. And one of the things I'm also taking out, and it was absolutely wonderful to work with Elaine Clotworthy from MIE. She was a superb partner to work with. And the wonderful thing about school tens is you can very often meet someone after you've been emailing and phone calling, and you meet them for the first time on the day of the first workshop, and you find out you think the same, your humour's the same, you click. But even more importantly, you find out that you're actually really doing the same things in two different places with the same people. For me, it's about how do we give our young professionals in training, and that's the only time I'll ever use that term, through ITE, the opportunity to act as agents of change, the opportunity to be acting as social agents of change for the common good. And it's about opportunities. This is what we were talking about. And if the success of Curry Primary School under Ashley, and I've been there and such a success, is because of what it actually does rather than what it talks about or theorises about, what I've taken from this conference and learned from this conference is about ITE needs to put its money where its mouth is and give our student teachers opportunities to do this. I want to tell you very briefly about a project that we're involved with in Stranmillis called STRIVE. It stands for Stranmillis Interventions Voluntary Experience. And it came about from a conversation with the head of education in one of the then Education Library Boards, where they talked about the fact that, as always, good projects like Signature to do with literacy and numeracy, we seem to have this penchant in Northern Ireland that when something works well, then that's when they take the funding away from it. So Achieving Belfast was another scheme, and there were schools in areas of social disadvantage in Belfast who had lots of people being able to come in through those two schemes and help with intervention strategies, help with one-to-one work, etc., etc. And I also talked to him about one of my hobby horses, which was how often do we provide practical, not theoretical, experiences for our students to engage with people who come from a different habitus than they do. So we got our heads together and we created this project called STRIVE. And I spoke about it very briefly yesterday, but I go and speak to each of our third years as they finish off and tell them we have a project that you can be involved with next year. You have to commit to 13 days during two semesters and then your final 7-week teaching block. There's no print vouchers in it. There's no coffee vouchers. There's no T-shirt. There's no certificate. You will work harder than everyone else. And by the way, you won't get that final teaching practice block in a school 2 miles from Mummy in a lovely leafy area in the hope that you get the job for two miles from Mummy. This is a challenge. So we have half a dozen to a dozen of our students who are brave enough. And I evaluated it a couple of years ago, and what I found for our students was this was the first time that practically they've been asked to reach inside themselves and do something different with those with whom they essentially had nothing in common from their own backgrounds. And all of those, bar about two, all of those students that I've worked with over the last 4 or 5 years have all gone and worked in areas of social deprivation afterwards, whether that's been in Belfast or whether that's been in Newcastle or Liverpool. And I think we need to do more of that in ITE. I think we need to put our money where our mouth is. So I'm sorry, that was my hastily put together after being asked.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. Yeah, well done. Yeah, it's unfortunate. We have an apology from the planned panellists. It just, illness seems to strike us all in various ways. John, you were you're a bit wobbly last night there as well. And but we're very, very pleased, very, very pleased that that Andy was able to step in and cover for Connor, who's not in the best of health just currently. Okay, Can I ask you please to look to your left and to your right? If you know the person beside you, that's grand. If you don't, introduce yourself now. You need to be sitting close enough to someone to have a conversation for the next part, please. This is my reach for the roof bit. So say hello if you don't know the person. If you do know them, say hello anyway.
Hello.
Now, here's your two-minute challenge, and it's only 2 minutes. This crowd are useless to timekeeping. You can see what they think of 3 minutes. But my 2 minutes challenge will be a 2 minute challenge. Thoughts, comments, reflections among yourselves, please, about what you've just heard. What did you make of the comments and thoughts so far? And then we'll have a few questions. Yes, go on, yeah. One minute, local time. Okay, now, the kind of hope that I had there was that a conversation would start. The challenge always is to get it to stop. There's never enough time to have those chats and whatever, but basically you've had a chance to sort of give it sort of an initial reaction or have a little quick chat in terms of what you heard from the various panelists. At this point, I'm opening to the floor. Any questions you want to raise? Any observations you want to make? Now is the first opportunity to do so. So we have microphones, or a microphone, I think, at least. Who's going to kick us off for a fiver? Okay, the gentleman with the very sharp tie. Thanks, John. Okay.
Thanks very much. John Anderson from the Education and Training Inspectorate. If common good is to mean something practicality in practical ways, it has to be about partnership. So I'd like to ask a question about partnership, and I don't mind if I direct it to John first, but I'd really interested to hear, you know, what others in the panel have to say, particularly those in schools. So, John, you mentioned, and I was reading something into what you said, at the end you said schools were massively enthusiastic about engaging in research-informed practice and partnership with ITE, but earlier on you made the point of saying that this was working only in a small set of schools.
Yes.
With growing numbers of student teachers. Now, I see a risk. I can see why that might be the case, but I can see the downside. I can see the risk. I'm overstating it slightly, but you can almost create a different class of school if you do that. So I wonder if the answer possibly lay in the answer to Paddy Walsh's question and Andy Brown's remarks that it's about money that makes it work. I mean, partnership's great. Conceptually, that teachers, initial teacher educators, student teachers, beginning teachers should all share together in school improvement. That's in the best schools in Northern Ireland, that's what happens. but that's the minority. So I really just wonder, from the point of view of practicality, of what schools are willing to engage in without money to share in partnership.
We'll go to John first, but then we will pop to the rest of the panel.
Yeah, I think it is a dilemma. Because there will be, in the model that we're putting forward in teacher education, then there will be some schools that are not involved. There are inner schools, most of the programmes are devised. They're working with 5, 10, 15 schools they work with very, very regularly and very closely and have very significant engagement with. And then there's a wider penumbra of schools where students will be going out as well and have a slightly more distant relationship, but still part of it. But there will be other schools that are not involved at all. That's absolutely right. And it seems to me that is a dilemma that you have to live with, because the idea of using teacher education as a vehicle to change all schools simply can't work. There aren't enough, there aren't the resources. So what you have to do is actually say that you have to work with some schools. Now, that's not to say that with other policies, and that's where the Welsh Government is being very positive, that they really are changing the collaborative culture. So that increasingly it is the schools in a town that are accountable rather than the individual school. All right, building relationships between principals and head teachers in a community, and actually saying, what do we do about the schools in this community and raising its achievement, and making sure that those links happen. So you can't do everything with initial teacher education, you can't. It can provide a very important vehicle, and it's a dilemma, but I think if you spread it too thinly, you end up with nothing at all. But there are other strategies that have to complement that.
Okay, Ashley and Lean, school perspectives on the same question.
I think there has to be other dividends apart from just the financial gain with something like this. I think collaboration, from our perspective, we are in a school principals group of 20 schools in North Belfast, which is quite different from any other ones because we are cross-sectoral. So we have Catholic maintained, controlled, Irish medium and integrated, and I think we are now buying into that collaboration, whereas before, you know, and certainly from the shared education point of view, where Siobhan and I, the two schools, were part of contested spaces funding 10 years ago, we didn't immediately go into the shared education programme, which had financial gains. We had a true collaboration and we ran for quite a few years without any financial funding, you know, and I think it comes from, I'm not going to say we should be running on goodwill, I'm certainly not saying that, but I think goodwill goes a long way, and I think if you're committed, certainly with the, you're investing in the workforce, you're investing in building the capacity of those future teachers, I think that's crucial to the system, and money is scarce, so we need to be creative in how we do it, but I just think collaboration in itself has so many dividends, you know, that we're certainly seeing that in North Belfast, which is great.
Liam?
Yes. Okay. I think that schools can become tiny little communities that can sometimes pretend to themselves that they are the only world, sometimes gated communities. And so there needs to be a constant breaking down of the walls around a school. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a locality, often schools can be competing rather than collaborating. But I do think that the key is to start with like-minded and to move from there. We're part of a variety of different networks. The Community and Comprehensive Schools have a network in the Republic, and that is very useful. We're also parts of networks of Protestant schools, the Irish School Heads Association, and they do some very interesting work, but it's within the public schools within that network that we'd be more closely aligned and therefore able to do the most interesting collaborative mm-hmm. work. But I think it is crucial to counter the notion that our school is the most important school in the world.
Okay. Yeah. Maeve and Andy, do you want to?
Yeah.
in another life when I was a home school community liaison coordinator for four schools in inner city Dublin. There were two schools on a lane called Basin Lane, and it wasn't to do with religious division in the sense that maybe you're talking about, but one was run by the Christian Brothers and the other by the Sisters of Charity, and then there were two non-denominational schools. But the two schools with that lane running down the middle, one was a boys and one was a girls, and there was very little cooperation or communication between the schools. So going back to that point I made yesterday about change, I think structure is really important. So structural change, such as setting up a homeschool community liaison scheme through the Department of Education. Money wasn't a part of that, and I really agree with that. So it was through the leadership of the two principals, the vision of this particular approach to partnership, and through somebody being released from teaching to actually go and work with the teachers and to set up then among the four schools a local committee that hadn't existed in this small inner city community where there was no time really for people to have talked to each other, and they were competing with each other. And then out of the people in the community, the teachers, the principals, the social workers, the public health nurses, meeting every now and then, mm-hmm. we begin to feel like we have something mm-hmm. to say to each other, and also because we're working in a situation where there's really dire need for this. So money wasn't really what was needed, it was communication. Okay.
Yeah, just very briefly, that's an excellent point that John raises, and I think in a small community like Northern Ireland, especially within, well, going back to Liam's point, I mean, schools are quite rightly the centre of every community, but unfortunately I think schools tend to think they're the centre of the universe individually. And in a small community like Northern Ireland, many of the principals, especially in primary school, have all gone through our two colleges of education or some of the schools of education, and there's almost a moral responsibility that they feel for bringing students in and upskilling the next generation. And I suppose the thing that struck me as John gave his address and as John was asking his question is, I wonder what the inspection factor would be there. Would the fact that the schools are going to be, that's going to form part of their inspection report, be something that they would find that they wanted to latch onto very quickly? Or would that be not a chance? I'm not putting myself, my head above the parapet for anything else. So I'm just wondering how that would work in Wales with Aston or with ETI here.
Fair question, don't it?
No, I have nothing to say really.
Okay.
It was really the other way around, that lots of schools felt they were doing really good things and they had no credit for it. And they really want that to be supported. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting because the whole question of money is something that can sink partnership before it actually starts off. And I was reminded of that when you talked about the work that was done way, way back around the modes of teacher education and so on. The distinctions that emerged very quickly between licensing and chartered routes came down to two things in terms of the money that was going to the colleges and the universities and the monies that were going to the schools. And in so many ways, that was... I'm never sure it was accidental as a strategy, but it certainly derailed an awful lot of really good thinking in the early days around partnerships, around teacher education particularly. Okay, not a bad question. Thank you, John. Not a bad question to start us off. Can we have one or two more, please, and we'll take maybe two together and put them to the panel at that stage. Anybody else? I'm going to start singing if people don't.
I think one of the what I've heard, particularly from the schools and from John's presentation this morning, is the courage to take risks, not to be afraid. It's not about money. It's about actually having that passion to see and to experiment, mm-hmm. and then maybe to get that research going to see, will it actually, watch this space. I love that. That was the best last line. Watch this space. It is about professional development. It is about being supported. It is about not theory into practice, but bringing the different constituencies together to form that relationship that can make something new work. But it is about having that openness. And again, I'm going back to Kelcherman's writing on this, about we can't define the ends of education for ourselves. We don't really know always what's going to happen, and so we have to keep it that little bit open and be open to that vulnerability.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to the business. I've got nothing else to say. You know, go back to the business about what's driving you. And I, one of the things I said was that I am passionate about the university sector and what it can contribute. But I have been humble for a long time, and as I get older, more and more humble about what it can contribute on its own. I've spent my life being far too arrogant about how research and scholarship can change the world, and this absolutely cannot do that. It has to work in collaboration. It has to work in collaboration with the profession and with all people at all levels of the profession. There's no question in my mind. I've learned that particularly about doing this work in this most recent work in Wales, where you start to see, once the minister said, come and do this stuff and change it, all right, opening the door, giving me a pass to go into the ministry as a member of staff, and actually starting to realise that policymakers, 9 times out of 10, haven't got a clue what's going on in academic world in terms of research. I spent my life saying I'm writing all this policy stuff and it's being taken seriously and it's changing the world. No, it's not. It's absolutely not. No one knows about it. But it's actually getting inside, forming relationships in ministries, forming relationships with schools. That's when things start to actually change. And that means, I think, a greater sense of humility amongst the academy, and that recognising that, of course, rigorous academic research is vitally important, but unless you're working collaboratively, whatever your wonderful your values are, they're not actually going to change practice on the go. They're not going to get into Ashley's school. They're not going to be part of that everyday thinking. And that demands quite a lot more humility than, as an academic, I've spent my life professing.
Gosh. We can all go home after that, almost. Yes. And again, in each case, John did it, but just I should have said it beforehand. In each case, can you just introduce yourself briefly? We don't get out of here until I get a question from each table, by the way.
John Unsworth, Education Authority, Northern Ireland. So there's understandably been a focus on initial teacher education in our conversations this morning. I'm just interested in moving it on to career-long professional learning. And just interested in the views of panel members on how that can be developed, and think particularly the situation in Wales and how very exciting stuff that's working beginning to develop in terms of initial teacher education, and wondering what the developments are potentially there, and the role of universities and HEIs in contributing to that, and also reflecting on the really important work that schools in our system in the north are doing for themselves with, you know, within and in partnership with other schools in terms of supporting their own professional learning, and none of that necessarily being accredited or recognised in any sense, but they're getting on with it. So just interested in panel members' views on that, on how this can continue in a career-long way.
Okay, again, an excellent question. So really, it's shifting the ground slightly. We're now looking at teachers' professional learning, sort of post-initial rather than in the initial phase. School perspective, perhaps, to start off? Do you think that this is...
The classrooms have completely changed, I would say. They're unrecognisable from what maybe 26 years ago when I started, what it would have been like. And with that, we need to change our practice. You know, there's maybe a few... I always used to, when I first started, you know, there were the dinosaurs in the corner. I'm now the dinosaur in the corner, so I'm always trying to make sure that, you know, we always do have a real range, actually, of ages and experience, and that keeps us always very fresh. But I've been very, very proactive in my own CPD, so I think that's really important for the staff to see that, but also listen. And name it, you know, say, yeah, it doesn't look the same anymore. This is not going away. These issues, we have, you know, we maybe would have had 2 children that we were concerned about 20 years ago. We now have 2 children in our preschool, 24 children, two children were identified that we are not concerned about, and that's quite shocking. We've over 50% of our school on our special needs register, and we're probably being kind there. So that's a lot to manage. So we need to build the capacity of our teachers. We also need to build their resilience and be mindful that burnout is a real thing. And I do preach this. I don't maybe practice it all the time, but you know, it's really important to look after ourselves, look after, you know, and identify CPD. But I know what you're saying, John, because a lot of this collaboration, people can sell themselves as, I'll demonstrate good practice, and no one's actually regulating that. And I have gone to some things and thought, no. So we have to be wary of that, and we have to have some kind of management of who is standing up and sharing good practice.
That's brilliant. Thank you. Liam?
I'm not sure this is going to answer that question at all or not, but one of the challenges with those who are recent qualified teachers is that they come into a staff room and there's a culture that they take on. And sometimes it can be a challenge to bring the new into an existing staff room, and I think this is a real challenge for school leadership, but one that's relatively easy to get around if you're in the Republic we call them now PMEs,
PGCE, training.
Those who are undergoing teacher education and are in placement in your school, to provide them with the possibility of actually teaching the teachers who are there 10 or 15 or 20 years, and to structure that is actually rejuvenating for the staff as a whole and breaks down some of those cultural barriers. I did want to come back to, and forgive me if that wasn't a proper answer to your question, because I was thinking about what John was saying about the policy makers and researchers, and the fact that policy makers aren't always aware of what researchers are doing, and vice versa. And I'm going to an unashamed plug: if anyone is interested in global education, development education, human rights education, we've set up a little network based in the Institute of Education in London, which is about bringing together policymakers in European countries and researchers in those fields, so that the policymakers can be informed by research, and so that the researchers can also know what are the questions that policymakers are interested in. It's a very limited field, but if anyone's interested, it's an open network. And finally, on the question of money, I'd hate to think we'd left here with any suggestion that money wasn't important, because I'm half joking, but we have seen some evidence of very interesting initiatives that use a little bit of money strategically, and some of the creative cluster work that the Department of Education in the Republic has facilitated recently, I think, is very interesting, because it's about getting like-minded schools that are different together.
Yes, on the note about money, I did spend the last two summers applying for additional funding from every charity, every grant, every possible thing to pay for music therapy and counsel and things like this. Here, money is extremely important, and I just think we need to be showing other government departments just how much we're delivering their policies, and I think they should be working collaboratively with us, especially health. In our particular context, the Department of Justice, I can't understand how they don't invest in education early on and early intervention, because if they don't, we are going to cost them a fortune in the future. So I think that is really, really important that they get on board and start collaborating with us now. But they're a hard nut to crack, but we are continuing, as John knows, I am continuing to knock their door.
Just very, very briefly, our college motto is Descendo Discimus, which means, as you'll all know, Latin speakers amongst you, through teaching we learn. And why is it that the one profession which should be the one which celebrates continuing professional development amongst its staff, is the one that doesn't. So you do another course or another certificate or another degree in many walks of life, you get promoted and more money, and then the education, it doesn't. But the problem is when any system, well, certainly when education systems start to lose money, or you can see coming over the hill the fact that money's starting to become tight, what's the first thing that falls within education? It's CPD. And there's no time, there's no money, certainly in the north. There's no sub-cover, and there's no opportunities. And yes, as always, individual schools are brilliant at being resilient, and individual principals are brilliant at sourcing funding and brilliant at doing homegrown CPD. And also one of the things that's happened in certainly in Northern Ireland has been teach meets. Teach meets have come from the ground up, where at Queen's, at Ulster, Strand, hotels, wherever, somebody who works in the RE teaching community or the English teaching community, you know, on social media, they'll say, come to such and such a place at Friday night at 7:30 and we'll spend a couple of hours, and it's teaching me. Wonderful. Isn't that great? From the ground up. Well, actually, no, I'm not sure that it is great. Because whilst you might get lots of really good chats and networking and lovely, you know, conversations and swap lesson plans, where's the research-informed CPD there? So, yes, there is, as you said, John, there's opportunities, I think, for higher ed, for ITE, to be doing stuff within that. And I think it's nice to see that that's been recognised, and even a shift within a year to see that, John. So whenever shared ed people said, we're going out to the ITE institutions to look for them to deliver some modules, what they did last year was, we need the following modules delivered. What they're doing this year is saying, what modules could you deliver? Which plays to the strength of the places as well.
Okay, very useful. Yes. Do you want, are you leaning forward, Maeve, to jump in? Or?
I'm just thinking about public sector workers in general and the whole issue of teachers as a profession and how the private funding, the privatisation issue and the kinds of funding that goes to private education obviously has an impact on public education, but it's not just that, it's the view of the professional, who's engaged in public work for a common good is seen as somehow not a professional and has been deprofessionalised, and their status, and even in terms of respect for the work that they do in the public view, how media itself has contributed to that view that, you know, sure, anybody can do it. So I think that issue of accreditation of work that's done and recognition is really important.
And we had a very interesting comment last night from Padraig Hogan in terms of when he's launching the John Coolan Award. He made a very astute observation about the fact that in all down the years, John Coolan made a particular point of staying in touch with policymakers all the way through, even if you don't kind of, you know, just to be having those conversations on the side, because it's profoundly important, even if there wasn't an immediate gain to be seen. And it's a kind of partnership we don't think very much about, because it's the kind of partnership that's hardest to construct in many ways. And I remember the kinds of experiences that, you know, have come up from time to time when you try to convene a forum that brings policymakers and educators into the same frame. Very challenging in so many ways. But that's just an observation rather than anything else. We have time, folks, for probably one, maybe two more questions. I'm very aware of the fact that we've heard only male voices in and among the questioners so far. So are there any of the I was going to say non-male. God, I'd be thrown out of the rest. Are there any questions, say, for example, from the younger group here? Have you got anything to raise for us that you want to put to the panel now that you have an opportunity? I'm putting you on the spot. It's not fair, I know. Come on, one person, rise to the challenge. Yes, thank you. Okay, immediate pass. Let me know when your vibe is on, and I'll
So introduce yourself and then...
My name's Megan. I'm a PhD student at Queen's University. My studies are around pedagogy and how a teacher's perspective actually impacts their practice in teaching controversial issues related to the conflict. So it'll be around citizenship education. And because my focus is on pedagogy, I'm wondering how do pedagogical approaches kind of influence the programs and modules that are actually developed for teacher education, and also in terms of as principals of schools, how do they actually influence your take on curriculum and your ethos of the school as well?
Thank you very much. Excellent question. Will we start in the middle this time, Maeve? Brief response.
I think there's real hope around this. I think because of the basically that, if you like, tension between theory and practices being challenged. So new pedagogies are appearing from, I suppose, the critical emancipatory space. Yeah. So even to see Zimbalist's work on love as an ethico-political concept and pushing for a revolutionary pedagogy through teaching for emotions, but then this big going for the big one called love. But not that, as I said yesterday, that this is a soft, fuzzy concept that, you know, we're going to teach love. But actually, it's about love of my fellow man, woman, and not binarized love of another person. And surely that's what education is about. It's about the relationship. So I think there's a great deal of movement. And I actually think people like Vanessa Andreotti and those post-colonial theorists have really, they've Maybe. Gone to the mark, you know, to, right to the edge on this.
Okay. Andy.
Answer
okay, John, you're on.
Well, I don't know the answer to it really, but well, maybe gives an example, a case in point, that she is sitting in a position in a higher education institution where, through her scholarship, she is able to be in touch with international conversations and to bring those into teacher education. And so that is an example of what it is that higher education really has to contribute. But again, it has to be done in a context where those conversations can be had with people in school, where the action takes place. And it's actually saying, it's a really fabulous example, what you just said, about why it is that has to be a collaborative approach, and what it is that university and the higher education institution really has to offer that isn't consistently available in all schools. But you can't do it on your own, that's all. So one of the things that we're interested in is, in Wales, because the English model has gone down this line of actually saying schools can do it themselves, and they've got a budget, and they now run the budgets for much teacher education, and they can buy in a bit of university stuff if they want it. What we've really been pushing in Wales is that you've actually got to find ways of actually bringing the two together, and that's how. But that was just a lovely vignette about what it is at best higher education has to offer, challenging thinking informed by national and international work. Brilliant.
And the new ways, I think, of being and doing when you get into ITE, if you look around Europe and you look around, in fact, if you look around the world and you see that the courses are now available, and you could be doing a course and posting on a discussion board at 11 o'clock at night with somebody from Dubai or Paris or Nashville or Belfast or Monaghan, and that brings an amazing degree of globality into your thinking. But then the question, I go back to my earlier point in the bit that I'm hammering on about this couple of days, is how does that then get put into practice in your local community? And you know as well as I do, given what you're studying, the barriers that can be put in place within the local community because of the context, the dynamic, and we look at the pockets and the areas of social disadvantage. We look at who the aspirational role models are for young Protestant working class boys. If the person that drives the large SUV in your estate is the drug dealer or the paramilitary or whatever, then what's the need for education? So it's wonderful to have opportunities at IT and higher education, but it's about how those then get translated into community context.
Very good point. Ashley, do you want to round it out for us?
I don't have a lot to add, but I think it's about knowing, as Andy says, you know, your local context as well, but to be brave. Just, you know, my daughter is fourth year student teacher, and that's what I am instilling her all the time. Be brave, take the risks, you know, and, you know, if you're always working in the best interests of your children, you can't go far wrong.
Very succinct, very well put. Thank you. Liam?
Yeah, coming back to the question of pedagogical approaches, it's crucial. I mean, I run a school where it's all over our ethos that we're about justice, we're about the relationship between local and global issues. But that matters not a damn unless what's happening in classrooms mirrors that and the pedagogical approaches are congruent. So, you know, participatory, emancipatory, democratic approaches that empower student voice. Without them, the rest is just blah. So I think your question is about what's crucial for social change. Thank you.
And I think we're going to leave it on. That's two very, very positive notes to close out on. And I think we're going to leave it at that, Noel, if that's all right with you. So can I ask Noel please to come forward as Northern Chair to close events for today and to thank the panel family.
So just some quick concluding remarks. I'm conscious of time. We said we'd finish at 1:30. Lunch is at 1:30, so I promise we'll be finished by then. I think it's fair to say, certainly from our perspective, we think this has been a really successful conference, and I hope you agree with that. Our theme of education as a common good has been an engaging theme for all of us. It's been a challenging theme, actually, as well. I've found at times that I was profoundly destabilized in my thinking and challenged and provoked. And that's probably a good thing, isn't it, for all of us to be challenged in the way we think about things. And I hope that's the case for you as well. And I hope that thinking just doesn't finish at 1:30 as you begin your lunch, but that thinking continues and the dialogue and the discourse continues even after this conference. Scotens is about many things, isn't it? It's about making connections. It's about renewing old acquaintances. It's about making new connections. And I hope a lot of those things have happened over the last couple of days. It's about boundary crossing, to use the Etienne Wenger's term as well. And I hope that if this is your first time at Scotens in particular, and I look at our doctoral students here, for many of you, I'm sure it's your first time here, but for others as well, I hope you find this a welcoming conference, a friendly conference, an interesting and engaging conference as well. Let me just thank a number of people. Obviously, our two keynote speakers I have to thank in particular, Professor John Furlong and Dr. Maeve O'Brien, for two really inspiring addresses yesterday and today. All of our workshop facilitators, Andy Brown and Elaine Clotworthy, Aoife Lynham, Barbara McConnell and Connor McGuckin, and Paddy Walsh and Gary Granville, thank you so much for all the work and the collaboration that you've put into the planning for those workshops, which you've had to run twice, I know, over the last couple of days. But I know a lot of people have felt it's been really important that they've been able to get to at least two of the three workshops. So thank you for agreeing to stay for the 2 days and to run your workshops twice. To our panelists, I've thanked many of them already, but in particular Ashley and Liam, who have come out of their very busy school schedules. But it's been really fascinating for us and important for us, I think, as teacher educators, to hear the perspective of school leaders and what school leaders we've managed to bring along today. So thank you in particular to Ashley and Liam. Our doctoral students, this is the third time only that we've had a doctoral roundtable at the Scotens Conference. I think it's now pretty firmly established as an annual event, and it brings a youth and a vitality to our conference. You are very welcome, our doctoral students, and we hope that you do come back, and we look forward to hearing of the progress and hearing of the successful Viva outcomes in years to come. I do have to thank on behalf of the committee the Centre for Cross-Border Studies, and in particular Emer and Tricia and Ruth, who have done so much groundwork for this conference. I mean, some of the rest of us some of the rest of us just stand up here at the front and try to look pretty. But really, really, Emer and Tricia and Ruth have done all the donkey work behind the scenes. So a huge thank you to them. And to the my fellow members of the School 10s committee. We meet right through the year, and the planning for this conference started many months ago. My fellow co-chair, Kathy Hall, as well, for chairing yesterday. This is the first time that School 10s has been in Newry. I think it's been a great experience. This is a lovely hotel, and it wasn't it great yesterday to have Councillor Charlie Casey come and open our conference, and also the fact that Charlie came back last night for the dinner. So we have felt very welcome in Newry, and in particular in the Canal Court Hotel. It was also a real privilege, I think, for us all to have Mary Coulihan here last night, the widow of one of our founding members, John. So what an honour it was to have Mary with us last night, and for Padraig Hogan to make the inaugural award of the John Coulihan Award. And Sheila Noonan, of course, who was able to join us to launch our annual report. Finally, last but not least, can I thank you as delegates for taking time out of your busy schedules. I know, speaking on, you know, as a representative of Stranmillis here, many other colleagues of mine would have loved to have got here, but teaching is so frenetic at this time of year, and so thank you for making the sacrifice and rejuggling your classes and reorganising so that you were able to be here, especially if it's your first time. Two things will happen after you leave. One is that you will receive an email, probably from Emer, with an evaluation. So please do take time to complete that evaluation. And we do consider that as a committee. We want to make the conference next year even better. And also, a number of people have asked me about PowerPoints and audio recordings, and I'm hoping that Dermot's been recording the keynote sessions, and PowerPoints should be available on the website within the next week or two. So do look out for those on our website. Next year, we normally take it year about, so I would imagine next year we'll be south of the border, we'll be in the European Union next year. If you're from Northern Ireland like me, we may need to bring our passports, who knows? We could need to allow extra time for crossing the border next year. But I just wish you all a very safe homeward journey. Do stay for lunch if you can, and we look forward to seeing you all again next year. Thank you.